In the Buddhist Vajrayana conception of enlightened state, there is an idea of the four aspects of Buddhahood, and often referred to as the five Buddha families. And the fifth one is Amoghasiddhi, whose color associated color is green, and it is really seen as a kind of a convergence of all the other qualities. Mm.
An auspicious beginning, Your Holiness. We're very happy to be back. Yesterday was quite a day. I think perhaps a mental marathon, a long journey through many complicated ideas. Some sparks were flying at the end, and perhaps they were making space for some new openings in our thinking. Certainly, from my perspective, I felt that. The sessions yesterday ended with Michelle and Christophe sharpening their points of difference about the relationships between mind, brain, consciousness and experience, and the challenges that we saw them put to each other more and more clearly, more and more sharply, were tremendously illuminating, I think, for us all. So I want to express my gratitude, our gratitude, to both of you for venturing into the lion's den on our behalf. We learned from your courageous encounter. Your Holiness then suggested, after they had had their conversation, that we need to clarify our definitions of what we mean by consciousness. And when you said that, I felt some clouds lift, some clarity enter. And then Richie followed with the observation that one very important function of consciousness is to regulate our emotions, that the angry faces, like the ones that we weren't able to see consciously in the slides that Christophe was showing us, that those angry faces can cause us to make negative judgments later on, of which we are entirely unaware, ignorant or prejudicial judgments of which we might be ashamed if we knew we were making them. And Arthur pointed out then that this observation, Richie's observation, brings us back to the ethical questions that are motivating much of our work and our dialogue together. He said all that philosophizing that we've been doing is not just for fun. We did have fun. It has consequences in the world. And that's our topic for today. I want to show you a slide of a picture that one finds in the West. There's a person we look to when we think about ethical problems in the Western world. His name is His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and this quotation one finds on posters and billboards and maybe even t-shirts and coffee mugs. And I think this quotation in some ways says everything we need to hear about this question of ethics. The Dalai Lama, when asked what surprised him most about humanity, answered, "I hope you really said this and they didn't make it up." What surprised you most about humanity? Man, because he sacrifices his health in order to make money, then he sacrifices money to recuperate his health, and then he is so anxious about the future that he does not enjoy the present, the result being that he does not live in the present or the future. He lives as if he is never going to die, and then dies, never really having lived. I think that's a very complete description of our human dilemma. So today we turn to that puzzle in part. I think every one of us will carry back home from our time together on this historic occasion with you memories and vivid impressions of our intense week here, wrestling with some of the most challenging, most profound, and enduring questions with which we humans have grappled through the ages. And in our lifetime, in this lifetime that's been given to us now, the pace of scientific progress is accelerating rapidly, with the stunning and, in some cases, exponential advances in the technologies of investigation, of computation, of communication. Christoph said yesterday, I hadn't heard this, that the internet is now as complex as the human brain. That's a mind-boggling thought for this brain, anyway. In spite of the unprecedented pace of change, it was clear, I think, by the end of the day yesterday, that we will have to be patient, however much we may disagree about what is ultimately knowable in some varieties and senses of knowing, which we, I think, also have to define. Christoph wants to measure it all, and he thinks he can. The Frenchmen, Michel and Mathieu, want to reserve a space for not only experience, but perhaps we can say mystery. Arthur, ever the optimist, is intent on building a bridge across that divide. It was all quite fascinating and even fun. And meanwhile, there is no doubt that we see misery all around us, and we see ignorance and what seems like willful disregard of dangerous forces that we humans have unleashed on the world with these big brains of ours that need big hats with many holes. So this brings us to what I often experience in my personal life as the largest question of all, which is, how then shall we live? Today we will hear from six presenters who are addressing these pragmatic and more immediate questions in their work. As with the natural scientists and philosophers with us here, our speakers today stand in for a great and growing cadre of scholars and educators and activists who are doing this work. They will help us explore what we have learned, what we are learning, about applications of contemplative practice to relieve human suffering, to promote human flourishing, the two prongs of the mission of the Mind and Life Institute that has emerged out of the quarter century of dialogues hosted by Your Holiness. Emerged, I should say, not by accident, but with wise and patient cultivation over those 25 years by, first of all, Your Holiness and many dedicated people inspired by your vision, by your presence. Your presence has had a profound impact on our discussions over these past 4 days. The depth of your engagement, the generosity of your listening, the originality of your questions. We have all been deeply touched by that, and we thank you for it, and we marvel at your stamina and your resilience. Today, with these reports from the field of practice and application in clinical and educational programs, as well as broader scale social interventions, we will see some of the fruits of your energetic and conscious cultivation, like the trees planted decades ago to line the roads of this settlement so that residents today can enjoy the shade and the beauty without even knowing who it was that put them there. Jimpala recalls and told me last night that he, as a young boy, was involved in the very hard work of taking care of those very small saplings and making sure that they could grow into big trees. As we have said repeatedly about the big questions in philosophy and physics and neuroscience, there is a great deal we still need to learn in this messy field of applications we enter today. Today's presenters will offer a flavor of the kinds of work being done and an appreciation, I think, for the passion of the people doing that work, planting seeds to benefit generations yet to come. We'll begin with my friend and colleague, Sona Demijian. She's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at the University of Colorado in Boulder, Colorado. She's involved, has been, with the Mind and Life Institute on the Research Advisory Board, very helpful and important in that role. And she does studies of clinical applications of mindfulness-based training. She will provide us with an overview of that field. You know, your friend Jon Kabat-Zinn has been instrumental in beginning that series of studies, and it is blossoming. And Sona will give us a sense of that. She is an important investigator in that area. Her particular focus has been on depression, and within depression, on depression among women who have, during pregnancy or right after having given birth. So, but she has a much broader overview of this area of endeavor that she will present to us. So with that, Sona.
Actually, Diana, the person who was responsible for those trees is actually here, Greta Jensen, the appropriate technology for Tibetans.
Is that right?
Yes.
Well, we appreciate them. Thank you.
Sorry to interrupt.
Thank you.
Your Holiness, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today about this work. We've had wonderful presentations, as Diana mentioned, from different facets of science, neuroscience, physics. And today I come representing really a tradition, the facet of clinical psychology. And I work as a professor and also as a practicing clinical psychologist, so working with patients who are struggling with problems like depression. And I want to begin with a picture of the University of Colorado at Boulder, which is my home and where I work, which is, as you can see, nestled in the foothills of the Rocky Mountains in the United States. Beautiful place, although I know from Mechila's photographs, not as majestic mountains as in Tibet and Nepal, but a wonderful place to live and work. And I show this picture to begin because in the history of clinical psychology, there was an important meeting that took place in this university in 1949. And that meeting codified an approach to training clinical psychologists that said that it was essential to include science. That said it was essential to include science as part of the curriculum, that although psychology had a long history of practice and clinical application, what was necessary was to integrate that with scientific principles and scientific methods. And I know from the wonderful meeting that we all had with the monastic community yesterday and talking with that, hearing from the abbots and meeting with them last night, that this moment in 1949 in the history of psychology is nowhere near the magnitude of what is happening here and the reason that we're speaking here today. But I think it's an important point of connection because what that meeting and that model, which has become known as the Boulder model, and it guides the training that's delivered in my department and departments like the one where Richie is, really said is that science and practice can come together in a way that mutually elevates each one, that there's an important dialogue between the two, so that science is not eclipsing or obscuring the importance of application and practice, but really the integration of the two helps to enrich and enliven and improve each individually. So if we look at the history of clinical approaches in the West, and I don't have time to discuss all of these, but there are a number of different clinical approaches to alleviate human suffering that have been developed in the West. What the Boulder model and similar efforts really underscored was the importance of bringing a scientific approach to the study of these applications. Now, among these approaches, the ones that have received the greatest and the most rigorous kind of empirical testing have been the behavioral and the cognitive behavioral therapies. And I'm going to talk about those a little bit today because it's those therapies that have been integrated with a meditation practice is delivered in Western healthcare settings. And in order to do that, as Diana mentioned, there's really one place that we have to start in terms of the history of these efforts in the West, and that's with someone who's well-known and a good friend to you, Jon Kabat-Zinn, who basically took in the 70s the practices from the Buddhist tradition, meditation practices, and began to deliver those in a purely secular context with patients in Western healthcare settings. He will talk a little bit more about the types of practices that he used, but he delivered these under an umbrella term, which was mindfulness. So the delivery of mindfulness-based stress reduction was the original program that he developed. Now, initially, that program was applied primarily to physical health types of problems like chronic pain. And it was initially greeted with some kind of skepticism in the Western healthcare settings. But what we see over time is a huge increase. I'm going to show you a page from a report from the Institute of Medicine, which is can't really get any more sort of mainstream in Western science, which said, as it was defining priorities in 2009, that one of the national priorities for healthcare research was to evaluate mindfulness-based interventions in areas like anxiety, depression, as well as pain, cardiovascular risk factors, and chronic disease. So there's some sense that these practices of mindfulness meditation have an important role in helping people to get well and stay well in the context of illnesses that in the West and really globally have been very chronic and difficult to treat. This mandate or this priority raises raises important questions that are the kinds of questions that the field of clinical psychology seeks to answer. And I want to talk about those by talking in detail about some studies and some of the nature of this intervention called mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And I want to address four questions together today. One is, what's the rationale for using mindfulness meditation for problems like preventing depression? Why do we think that teaching people mindfulness meditation will be helpful for that purpose? And then the question of how do we do that? So what's in the toolbox, essentially, of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy? And we'll look together at this question of does it work? And how do we know that? As well as what are some opportunities and challenges that exist as we look to the broader horizon? So as I said, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, it's this very interesting integration of cognitive behavioral strategies and practices and mindfulness meditation as brought to healthcare settings by Jon Kabat-Zinn. And there's a quote, there's a lot of debate in academic psychology circles in the West about what does the word mindfulness mean. This is a definition, a kind of operational definition that Jon Kabat-Zinn gave, which he said it means paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. And this program was developed by some dear friends and colleagues of mine, Zindel Siegel, with whom I think you have spoken, Mark Williams and John Teasdale. And it's an 8-week class that's focused on teaching these skills to help people prevent depression and promote their well-being and their wellness over time. Now, let's look together at this first question that I raised, which is, why would we want to pull from these practices of meditation for this purpose? And in order to answer that, as clinical psychologists, we want to start with the question of what's the nature of the problem that we're trying to alleviate here? And depression, we know, is a heterogeneous, it's a complex problem that's experienced by many people. And there's much effort in science now trying to figure out exactly what depression is. But we define it now clinically by the experience of the presence of sadness that exists in a protracted sort of way, as well as a withdrawal from things that people enjoy and that give them a sense of pleasure and meaning, as well as a number of other kinds of experiences. One of the things we know about depression is that it's something that tends to persist in some form, and it's even after you have recovered from a period of intense depression, you're vulnerable to becoming depressed again. And in fact, the more times you've been depressed, the more likely you are to be depressed again. Now, one of the compelling explanations for that fact is this construct of cognitive reactivity. And this has to do with the way in which people's thoughts are sensitive to the experience of sadness. I want to show you a study that my colleague Zindel Siegel did, and I'll explain, there are two parts of it on this slide, I'll explain both of them on the next slide. What he did was he treated people who had been depressed to a point of wellness. And then he asked them about the kinds of attitudes that they held, how strongly they believed in these attitudes. He asked them attitudes like, if I fail at my work, then I am a failure as a person. Or attitudes like, turning to someone else for advice or help is an admission of weakness. Or, if a person I love does not love me, it means that I am unlovable. And people gave their responses to how strongly they believed in how strongly they held these attitudes, these thoughts. And then he asked them to listen to very sad music. And then he asked them to recall a time in their life in which they felt very sad. And then he asked them again, after this period of time, how strongly they held these or similar types of attitudes. What he found was, and then he measured how likely they were, or whether or not they experienced depression over the next year and a half period. And what he found was, this graph here, just to explain it to people, is called a survival analysis. And what that means is that each line depicts an episode of someone becoming depressed again. So essentially, the lower the line goes, the more negative the outcome suggests people are relapsing into a state of depression again. The solid line at the bottom demonstrates the people who had the strongest reaction of their thoughts to feeling sad were at very high risk of relapsing into depression again. The people whose thoughts were not so reactive, so if you felt sad, and basically you had this, your attitudes you held about as strongly before you felt sad as you did after you felt sad, you were less vulnerable to getting depressed again. But after sadness, if your thoughts increased in the strength in which you believed things like, if I... and so what this suggests is that it's exactly at these moments when people experience emotions like, people who have been depressed experience emotions like sadness, that they're most vulnerable. You spoke about this, I think, 2 days ago when you were talking with Richie, I think, and mentioned in the experience of sadness how it's important to have a kind of courage or a conviction for action. And what we see in studies like this is that when people respond to sadness not with that kind of conviction to act, but instead an increase or an amplification of thoughts like,
Shumba,
if I fail, then that means I'm a complete failure and there's no hope or encouragement here, then they are at greater risk of relapsing into depression.
Mare, tanda ti kutu terusya cipta cipta nanti pena peng susu lega cik manti pena. Kata ngaji tu cahne jengko mare sedek samtang nanti yo na. Tiri ti sem kobo ke nyongor cung pena. Ane tiri tengke sumpah kaya suksi rosi. Ane cizam ke sumpah kaya suksi woi apa tiki ti ane ngaman depression cung cik apa ti kiar tu yang depression yang ane tu yang ayeke niaga cie yo berusia.
Sometimes patients with whom I work will respond to knowing about data like this and say, well, I don't want to be sad anymore. I'd like to eliminate the experience of sadness. And as we talked about the other day, that's not possible, but also probably not desirable even for us as human beings. But what we can do is help people practice in these moments ways of regulating, ways of working skillfully with the emotion of sadness and the thoughts that arise that help them stay well over time. And that's exactly where this toolbox, the Geshe La who spoke yesterday or the day before had this wonderful line on his slide which said the toolbox for preventive benefit. And I think that's what this treatment, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, this integration in a sense of Buddhist mindfulness practices from this tradition as well as the Western cognitive behavioral tradition offers that to us. So can I spend just a moment describing the tools within this toolkit? From the mindfulness meditation standpoint, we teach people formal practices of mindfulness of the breath, of the body, of the experience of hearing, and then moving from there to the mindfulness of the process of thinking itself, the experience of emotion. But we ask people who participate in this class to practice 30 to 45 minutes of formal practice every day. And they do this in a way that's guided by the instructor. But we also ask them to practice in informal ways. So for example, mindful eating, or mindful brushing your teeth, or driving, or drinking a cup of tea. From this practice of mindfulness, the intention is really that people begin to become familiar and intimate with the nature of their own mind. And for people who've experienced depression, what that often means is becoming familiar with the distracted nature of their mind and the rapid nature of moving into a kind of automatic mode. Now we move from this foundation into the cognitive behavioral strategies, which really look carefully at what is the territory of depression? What are the warning signs of depression? And how can you bring the attention and awareness that's cultivated through the meditation practice to noticing how the mind moves in these automatic ways? So we often use the metaphor of automatic pilot, but in depression, when your mind is on automatic pilot like an airplane, it frequently flies not into a clear, vast, open sky, but one that's very turbulent and cloudy and dark. And so beginning to notice this at the earliest moments of shifting, and then how to step out of that automatic pilot and respond more skillfully. These practices are taught in the context of a group, and so people have the benefit of learning from one another and also from the guidance of the instructor, the teacher in the group. The attentional focus moves then across the 8 weeks on this gradient from more tangible, starting with literally the experience of eating a raisin, to less tangible, moving all the way up to what are the moments at which you're most vulnerable to your mind, in a sense, being hijacked by this stream of automatic thoughts. I want to include two quotes by people who described this experience after having done this course. And they describe, I think, the core skill here, which is this developing capacity to pause and to shift emphasis from the content of one's thoughts and the identification or the amplification of that content to an awareness of thinking as a process.
What differences? Yeah, background. For example, educated people.
Yeah.
Or less educated one. Mm-hmm. Or economically, well-being. Mm-hmm. Or middle class.
Yeah.
How much differences?
It's an excellent question.
So if that is a factor, then we're also begin recognizing that there are other factors that contribute regression, relapse, and so on.
So again, you cannot say this is absolute.
Therefore, you cannot attribute to the meditation practice the benefits you're seeing.
Some other element, their background. And also, I think, genes.
Genetic factors,
from parents, So everything very, very complex. Complex. Yes. Okay.
I agree with that completely. And one of the things I have watched many of these Mind and Life dialogues with you, Your Holiness, in the past years. And one of the things I love about these dialogues is that your questions often point to exactly what is important for the field to address. And I think you're doing that in this moment. It is very, very complicated. And I want to come back to this question, if I can, because what you're raising about these kinds of individual differences between people is exactly one of the places that we as researchers need to begin to devote ourselves.
사다보도 이렇게 자연하면은 제 갑종 미나단 되게 미치라고 되게 나단 담면다 될라 직심 버셔니 갑종 드네 인데 디체 대한 도스 누가 체 도스 탑시다 탑래 야 갑종 드네 잡데 야 드디 디선이 판도 체 도스나 알아 드네 간다 임지 다 리서치 그 지금
So Solness's question is the following, in the clinical Mm-hmm. practices and studies, has it ever been made an attempt that, for example, taking into account the specificity of the background of the patients, mm-hmm. whether it could be socioeconomic factors or levels of education factors or, and right. so on, and then based on those individual differences, suggesting different forms of treatment mm-hmm. that is really tuned to that particular background. Has any attempts been made to be that specific?
And
also people who have faith or non-believer background. Also make differences.
Religious background,
right.
and, you know.
Those are
and perhaps either age.
Age is a factor.
Mm. And the younger one who never faced a lot of problems. So once some problem happened, too much sort of what? Kasota.
Disturbances.
Older people, like water. I myself also include now old people. So you see, lots of problems we our lifetime used to face. So these people. These people, you see, mm-hmm. I think the because of the inner spirit, I think much stronger.
Stronger, right?
Much mm-hmm. stronger. So I think many other sort of factors.
All of those, I think, are very important. Age and developmental factors, socioeconomic status, education. One factor in history, like what is your individual history, is very important. Mm. So one thing that we know with this intervention in particular is that it's hit, and I'll have a slide on this later, but it's been shown to help people who have histories of highly recurrent depression. So it has, say I'm someone who has had three or more episodes of depression in my life. If I do this class, it helps to reduce my risk of getting depressed again in the future by half. I'm protected at that level. But the studies thus far have suggested that people who have fewer episodes of depression, they don't show that same kind of benefit. So it doesn't afford them the same kind of prevention that it would afford, say, someone with three or more episodes. Solon is wondering why that is the case. Yeah, it's a great question. It's actually one that's still an open question for science to answer definitively. The one theory is that as people experience more episodes of depression, these kind of links that I was talking about in the ways that thoughts become reactive to the experience of sadness strengthen, in a sense, or become more automatic over time. And so that's why this type of training can be particularly helpful. The other explanation that's sometimes given, although this is a theory or a hypothesis at this point, is that people who have experienced more depression in their life are in some sense more motivated to engage in the learning and the practice that's required because they have learned through a hard teacher, in a sense, of the negative consequences of having a mind that goes quickly onto automatic. But I will come back to this question that you're raising in a few moments as well. Let me just briefly to elaborate on the experience of this change, just give you an example of one mother who did this course who said, as a one of these difficult moments, I was holding my two-year-old, her son, and I put some milk in a cup, and he just threw it. It spilled everywhere. There was this really big mess. I was so frustrated. And the very first thing I did was take a deep breath.
Reminded, you know, Solomon said, was asked to, you know, put the drops of the polio medicine.
Two drops.
Oh. There were two young children here, sort of ceremonially. And one of the two children was very receptive, you know, immediately opened its mouth, and His Holiness was able to do it. The second one was refusing. He just kept his mouth closed like this. So he had to ask the mother to do it.
So I discouraged you. No, because of that, not much successful to try. So let mother do that. So little frustrations. Yes.
It's a wonderful example of exactly those kinds of moments. And the ability in that moment, as you did, to pause and actually find delight. Whereas people who experience depression, often what they'll do in those moments is to personalize it. So to say, what's wrong with me that I can't get this child to take the medicine? Why am I not capable of doing this? And does this mean that I'm generally not a very good person? Another person said, I have a much greater capacity for not letting myself get swept away by really intense emotion. And I have a greater capacity for being able to identify, and this part is really critical in terms of this core skill, that thoughts are not facts. I can unsee what's going on, what's happening in my thoughts, and I can step back from it and just watch it as a process. Here's, again, from my dear friend and colleague, Zindel Siegel, did a study in which he, again, in this time, I'm going to show you a graph that's similar to the one I showed last time. It's a survival graph, so each time the line goes down indicates someone becoming depressed again. But in this case, he treated people in this study until they were well, and then he randomly assigned them to one of three groups. One group, they stayed on medication. So they all had been treated to a point of wellness with antidepressant medication. And in one group, they stayed on their medication. In another group, they stopped their medication and they were given a placebo medication, but they didn't know that they were given a placebo. So those groups, they didn't know whether or not it was an active medication or a placebo medication. And the other group was given the 8 weeks of the mindfulness cognitive therapy training. Now, this study randomly assigned people, and that's really important because of the question that you were asking. So if there were differences in variables like people's education or their family background or their clinical history, the purpose of randomization is to ensure that those are equally distributed across those three groups. And that helps us to be able to make causal inferences about the effect of the treatment. So what you see in this study is that for...
I just want this to have a joke. I think among those depressed patients, I hope much less scientists who really use their brain constantly. So maybe their brain is quite strong.
At the end, yeah, no.
I hope.
His Holiness is hoping, is he hoping, right? In hoping that in this group of depressed people, very few scientists or none.
Those might be the most challenging, right?
Sometimes you say, Buddhists, so top scholars, but sometimes a little bit of depression. That then they feel, oh.
So I'm just saying that even among Buddhist scholars, sometimes you do see cases of depression. That sort of, you know, intrigues him. How can that be?
So scientists who are really dealing with these things, they themselves are depressed. That yes.
Sometimes that's what's so important about helping the people who help others. Actually. So just to, in the interest of time, just quickly say that in this study, among the people who had unstable periods of remission, so whose depression was resolved but still up and down, they were significantly aided by the mindfulness class compared to the placebo. Now, I want to get to my last sort of big point. So I'm going to move kind of quickly through the next three slides. This slide, Your Holiness, shows the number of publications in the scientific literature on mindfulness. And what you can see in the last, say, roughly 10 years, is this huge increase in the number of publications addressing the topic of mindfulness. Now, this is a sign of a lot of enthusiasm and excitement about these interventions and their potential promise. The work that I and my dear friend and colleague Cheryl Goodman at Emory University are doing is one example of this. So we're basically taking this course and applying it for women who are vulnerable to getting depressed when they're pregnant. We teach them this class when they're pregnant as an effort to avert or prevent the kinds of negative outcomes for babies and children that we've talked about over the last few days. Our initial data suggests that women's depressive symptoms improve and that improvement is sustained during pregnancy and postpartum. But I want to make my final point with this slide here, and I just want to take a minute to explain it in saying that this is a kind of map of clinical research methods that I use. One of my mentors, Steve Holland, often quotes one of his mentors, a great psychologist, Paul Meehl, who said, one of the defining characteristics of scientific psychology is the commitment not to fool yourself and not to fool anyone else. And this graph is a way of keeping us honest, I think, as scientists. And what you see on the horizontal axis is the probability of spurious effects. And what that means is the probability that an alternative hypothesis could explain the outcome that you observe.
clinical psychology research e bekal ya ne ga chu kar sa na su 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 go go ma te ba che ne xian go go ma da ya de le s ta ka sa su 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 go go ma te ba sa pu zen ka ne che ba che ba king dum de chu na na dum de de le nge le ya de xie xian da ga ya dum de su de xie xian da ji ge ton de ya tu tu na su su ta che che ba di ge gu di le den de bu de chung re sin na po tu gu ma ro as ta di.
And the vertical axis is our belief or our conviction in the evidence. And what this sort of trajectory says is that there's a hierarchy of scientific evidence, that not all evidence is equal, and that as a field develops, what we hope to see is a move from the lower left corner of non-experimental designs into the upper corner of experimental designs. Now, the graph that I just showed you of our study with women during pregnancy and postpartum, that, for me, it's exciting. but it's way down there in the bottom on non-experimental designs, right? It doesn't tell us anything. As much as I would love to say that we know that mindfulness training helps women during pregnancy, there's nothing in that study that allows me to make that inference. We've heard a number of reports, you know, today, and I often hear them where I live, about the effects of meditation practice. So someone might say to me, oh, I started meditating and I noticed I only need to sleep 2 hours a night now. It's great. And while these reports are intriguing, they don't tell us anything about the causal nature of that relationship, right? Now, the risk of where we are as a field is that a lot of our studies are clustered in the area of non-experimental or quasi-experimental designs.
The
danger, or the caution, I would say, for our field is that just because a lot of studies accumulate at that lower, at that left end, the risk is that people will have greater belief in that evidence. But in fact, the evidence itself is no more determinant, or it allows us, just because we have more people or more case reports or more open trials of the kind that I presented, it can increase our confidence, but it still has the same probability of a spurious effect still located there. So what's really important is that we move into these more rigorous experimental designs where we are doing exactly the kind of research that you highlighted. We're randomly assigning people to different groups with control conditions and examining factors like the kinds that you mentioned. The challenge of that is that it takes a very long time to do this work. So the study that say that Tanya's been doing in the area of compassion takes years to plan and execute. The study that I've been doing with the women with pregnancy, by the time we get from the non-experimental to the experimental design, that's the dedication of maybe a decade. The risk, I think, if we go to Diana's metaphor of the tree, our field right now is really like those little saplings. On the one hand, we want to ensure that people don't try and add too much weight on those on the basis of the quality of evidence that exists currently. On the other hand, we want to make sure that people don't abandon the effort of nurturing and cultivating them just because the research is challenging. And with that, I'll just end with a brief quote and maybe just a personal note, which is that one of the things I think that helps sustain this commitment to doing the best quality science is actually to see the act of doing science itself as an ethical practice. And your teachings have been a great guide for me in maintaining that motivation. And I want to end with this quote from a physicist. When we started with physics, and we can end with physics is here as we move into the rest of our day in application, Lord Kelvin said, "There cannot be a greater mistake than that of looking superciliously upon the practical applications of science. The life and soul of science is its practical application." Many of the greatest advances that have been made from the beginning of the world to the present time have been made in earnest desire to turn the knowledge to some purpose that's useful to mankind. And I think that I can speak for all of the scientists who and scholars who are here that really share, I think, the conviction that the doing of science itself is a practice of ethics in our world. And I want to just personally say thank you for your work and teachings have been a great source of inspiration. And also express gratitude to this wonderful group of colleagues and students who also make this work possible.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you so much. So we trade seats once again, and our friend and colleague Arthur Zients moves to the presenter's seat in a slightly different capacity. I'll move so you can get by. As everyone knows. Okay. We have known Arthur in these 4 days as a physicist, presenting complicated concepts of quantum mechanics. We have known him as a leader. Now we're worried about the computer, so I'll stop talking.
Thank you. Thank you.
We have known him as the leader of the Mind and Life Institute, the new president. But he's also been a leader in stimulating something he calls a contemplative pedagogy. So in higher education, in colleges and universities, teaching using contemplative practice as part of the educational method, the pedagogy. He and his colleagues have had major influence in that area, and he'll give us a sense, I think, of how that field has grown, talk about that progress, why it's important. And then he will also speak to a challenge that Your Holiness put to him and to the Mind and Life Institute at our recent meeting in New York, when you encouraged us so very strongly to turn our focus, in addition to the other things we're doing, to the question of education and secular ethics. Mm-hmm. How do we transmit these values mm-hmm. to the next generation? Mm-hmm. So with that, Arthur Zients.
Thank you. I'm afraid you'll become tired of seeing me.
Refreshment.
In fact, he's also saying that actually it's the opposite. Every time I see your face, it refreshes me.
The shining from here. eliminates ignorance.
All right. I wish it were so easy. Your Holiness, as you know, in addition to being active in Mind and Life and now the president of Mind and Life for over 30 years, I've been a teacher as well as a researcher, working with students roughly between the ages of, say, 17 or 18 and 23, 24, so young adults. And so I have been concerned as to how we can best care for their education. I think it's probably important to remember something about the history of such education. You know, in the West, in the Christian West, until around 1200 to 1300, all of the education took place in the monasteries and in the cathedral schools, the schools that were attached to the great cathedrals of Europe. They taught the traditions of religious scholarship as it was practiced in the West. Then about the 12th century, between 1100 and 1300, a whole new stream came into the Latin West, which was Greek philosophy, which had been more or less lost, especially the scientific aspects had been more or less lost to the West. It came almost like we are coming here, a kind of new science, a new challenge. There was no creator God. There was an emphasis on rational thought. There was an emphasis on observation, not yet experimentation, but early science. And the church, for a few hundred years, did not know what to do with this new philosophy of nature, this new way of studying that was represented by Plato, Aristotle, and the great Greek philosophers. You saw how Galileo, a few hundred years later, was tried for his science. But he was living in that tradition of the new science which began around 1200. There's a beautiful story of the students in Paris who wanted to learn about the Greek philosophy. The professors also wanted to teach what they were reading in the new Greek philosophy, but the church in those days forbade that. It was not part of the standard curriculum. And so what they did, the students and the professors, they went into the streets outside of the schools, and they put straw down in the street, and they sat and taught and learned outside of the cathedral schools. They were so passionate in their interests in finding a way to bring this new challenge, this new understanding into the old forms that they had. In some ways, I think we should imagine that the straw is under our feet, but now at your invitation, not outside of the monastery, but inside the monastery, which is, I think, much wiser and more future seeing, seeing into the future. One of the things which I think sometimes we skip over.
No. We lost the sound there. Maybe the battery, can you check the battery? Yeah, it's okay. Number four. We need number four to be switched on.
1, 2, 3. Thank you. Scientific technology is not always fail-safe, right? Before I touch on the contemplative, the meditative, the use of meditation in higher education, there are a couple of points I'd like to make. The first concerns what we might consider the purpose of higher education. I show here Harvard University's, I think that's Widener Library. It's one of the greatest libraries in the world at one of the great universities of the world. In the year 1200 in Paris, you had this challenge, and as a result of that challenge, the Sorbonne was created shortly after that as a great university in Paris. In around 1600, this great university was begun with a few professors and students, and now in the 21st century is one of the great research centers of the world. And yet, in those few hundred years, say from 1200 to the century in which we live, something has been, I think, forgotten, which many are beginning to recognize. This is one of the leading figures at Harvard, dean of the school of undergraduate education at Harvard College for those years, where he says, Harvard and our other great universities lost sight of the essential purpose of undergraduate education. They've forgotten their main purpose, which is to help students, quote, learn who they are, to search for a larger purpose for their lives, and to leave college as better human beings. Students are not soulless, but the university is. And at Yale University, a sister school, one of the deans there said, we have lost track of the purpose of education, namely, what life is for. A college or university is not just a place for the transmission of knowledge, but a forum for the exploration of life's mystery and meaning. We have seemingly forgotten these high purposes, these high aspirations. We are technically sophisticated, powerful information. And yet, I think here you have not forgotten. This is still clearly before you. I came across this quotation from Shantideva, which I've carried with me for many years, where it says, this entire preparation the sage taught. This entire preparation the sage, the Buddha taught for the sake of wisdom. Thus one wishing to bring an end to suffering should develop wisdom. So we are really dedicated to bringing an end to suffering. That is something which all of us now can agree to. I'd like to show a picture that was taken yesterday. This is the picture of a few thousand of your students. There are many more thousands elsewhere, but this is all we could fit in the picture. Somewhere I'm located in the middle there. But yesterday, during questions and answers, these students came to listen to what it is we had to say. And what we had to say, we hope, serves that purpose of wisdom such that it will end suffering. So let's commit to joining that purpose with as much of the practices and intelligence that we bring from both traditions, the traditions of Buddhist philosophy and practice, as well as the scientific traditions of the West. I'd like to turn to my favorite contemplative. As you know, Albert Einstein is one of my heroes. One of the things he is famous for is his ability to wonder, to ponder, to stand before the mysteries of the world and to deeply engage them. In one place he says, he who can no longer pause to wonder and stand wrapt in awe is as good as dead. His eyes are closed.
Sorry.
Einstein gave me conscious and the cheese the director that something maybe need to do well and bit chick Ricardo was on a headache nematon yet kitty.
To me, this is a kind of ethical stance before the natural world, that we stand before nature and its beauty, and we feel that beauty, and we stand wrapped in awe. And that awe, that wonder, is the beginning of the aspiration to know, to have the curiosity, to understand what it is that is there. And in order to do that, we need capacities, certain capacities, for example, of sustained attention, a capacity for imagination, to imagine the world differently, and to find sources of new ideas, new creativity. And I think all of these can be strengthened through contemplative practice. You remember, I think in Delhi I spoke about how Einstein had to think for up to 10 years on a particular problem sometimes in order to find that new idea, that new imagination. So the power of sustained attention, which, as Richie Davidson reminded us, is something which William James wrote about. He says, the faculty of voluntarily bringing back a wandering attention over and over again is the very root of judgment, character, and will. So we are so easily distracted. To be able to bring back our attention again and again is so important. And an education which would improve this faculty would be the education par excellence. It is easier, however, to define this ideal than to give practical directions for bringing it about. We find in the contemplative traditions of Buddhism, but other contemplative traditions, again and again, this practice, this way and methods and means for sustaining attention, voluntarily bringing it back again and again and again. As Jon Kabat-Zinn says, without judgment, but bringing it back persistently. Now, I showed a picture of Harvard University to begin with. I'm going to show another picture of Harvard University. Mm-hmm. Here you see, actually, Jon Kabat-Zinn, a number of his friends who are Harvard professors and MIT professors in the business school at Harvard University. You'll also recognize Diana Chapman Walsh here talking with Jon Kabat-Zinn, where she, together with myself and about 20 others, were part of a little retreat which takes place on a regular basis at Harvard University with participants from the faculty who are part of a working group. You see, that's, there she is. So Diana, Jon, myself, and Dan Goldman, other friends, and then other professors who you don't know from Harvard. In other words, some of the goals, some of the methods, some of the purpose which we've forgotten about from the contemplative traditions is now making its way into these centers of excellence in the United States. Here we are learning the practical dimensions of contemplative practice, how it might be brought into education at universities and colleges. We do this now through a couple of methods. We do this through, for example, a new association and center for the contemplative mind in higher education. We are now close to 1,000 members. There are a few thousand other professors at universities and colleges around the world who are also exploring how to bring meditation properly in a secular setting on a scientific foundation into higher education. I'd like to give just a couple of examples of some of the explorations that are going on. There's a practice which we call beholding. How is it we stand before a painting or a work of art and appreciate it not only intellectually, but artistically through long and sustained reflection and contemplation? There's a professor of economics and a colleague of mine who makes use of these so-called game theoretical exercises, these monetary games where you give out a certain amount of resources and money according to certain rules. And this tells you about the nature of the human being and their engagement with their fellow human beings around money. But what one finds is that those games come to different outcomes depending upon whether or not contemplative practice, loving kindness, for example, exercises have been done or not. This is something which Tanya Singer and Richie are researching in much more detail. But I feel confident that as that research develops, it will find its application more and more in the classroom. We'll be able to make use of these practices in ways that have the scientific foundations that are being discovered for them today. Now, I, in my own teaching, have for now perhaps 10 years made use of these sorts of practices over and over again, and I've come to a certain kind of set of design principles of what I think of, just to give Your Holiness a kind of picture of what goes through my mind when I'm about to teach a class using meditation. My first question is, who am I teaching? Are they young? Are they old? Do they know meditation or not? What is the topic that I'm going to be teaching? What is the content of that course? Then, what am I trying to achieve? Am I trying to achieve simply attention? Is that my exercise? Or is it a new content, in which case I might use an analytic meditation, such as Your Holiness often recommends, to take this difficult concept and first work with it analytically, and then let it settle and abide? So, in one case, it's simply the power of attention. In another case, it's a new concept. And then you can see in physics, there are difficult concepts. How is it I engage the students such that they analytically work with that concept and then let it settle? So I then decide on my pedagogical intent, and according to that pedagogical intent or aim, I then develop the practice as I just described to you. It's very important to give, I think, students also a rationale. These are unusual methods of instruction. It's not simply a standard lecture, and so they need to know why these methods are valuable. The instructions need to be clear, the students need to be able to ask questions, and then to lead them gently without forcing. Often I say you're always free in these moments. And then having done the process and practiced, then to give them a chance to write down what it is they observed, to talk with each other and to me about what it is they've discovered. What I have found to be, at least for myself, valuable about the contemplative pedagogy is that it does seem to support the development of attention, emotional balance, and certain other qualities of consciousness which are good for all students. Every student is a better student if they can be more attentive, more emotionally stable and balanced in their inner life. In addition, something which is not often talked about is that this is actually a way of understanding and researching. For example, in analytic meditation, one comes to know something which one did not really understand before. So there's an investigational quality, a quality of inquiry, a quality of research that's part of the meditation. And then there comes the moment where there's the apprehension, where you do understand. And then not only understanding, but let it live in you so that it becomes a way of seeing the world as well. This is a powerful transformation, an educational principle. It's more than simply information, but true understanding and then letting it settle to a real transformation of the whole view we have of the world around us and ourselves. We can also cultivate the qualities of empathy, altruism, and compassion. This is something we're going to hear about a little more later from James Doty, and Tunjin Jinpa has worked on that same project as well. Emery also has an important project with regards to cultivation of compassion. So we know that these qualities, which are so important for life, can also become part of our education. Now, this is not really part of education. This is something which takes place in the private lives of the students, but it can belong to a full, whole education of the human being. I'm afraid that the research in this area is only just beginning. There are thousands of people, professors, doing this kind of exploration, these kinds of attempts, but we do not yet have really, truly systematic studies, either at the university level, and maybe a little more is happening at the earlier level, but this is important. We have good studies on attention, emotional balance, but we don't have studies really of the effects on outcomes studies in higher education. So this is a need for the future. So just to remind us that there are these various associations and activities that support higher education, a network of thousands of professors who are meeting in conferences, summer research institutes like the One Mind and Life runs, but also there are others which are strictly focused on education. Retreats for professors come together fellowships that allow them to do new kinds of courses and innovations, newsletters and so on. There are many resources that take place. The conference, for example, with Jon Kabat-Zinn and Dan Goleman, many of them are now giving papers describing their own successful applications, sharing those details with each other, and going on retreats so that they can learn to practice for themselves what they will then teach later on. This is all concerning higher education. This is the work I have been doing for nearly 15 years now, I'd say, with colleagues, first a handful and now increasing numbers coming together in this, I think, important innovation. But parallel with the work going on in universities, you also are finding equally energetic application in the K-12, which means the early childhood, through the 12th grade. This raises a whole set of ethical questions, because the adults that I'm educating, although they're young, they are mature, they can make up their own minds. These children really are being cared for by their parents, and so the uses of these practices must be very carefully done, secular in character, and supported by good research wherever possible. But what one does find is that indeed there are individuals who are applying these methods to cultivate attention, to elicit pro-social behavior, and now we could say your charge to us concerning secular ethics. I don't have time to talk about the dozens of programs that are going on, but I'll pick just one by Kimberly Schonert-Reichel, who has developed something she calls a mindfulness education program, which makes use of these three areas of mindful awareness, social and emotional learning, which has got quite a lot of research behind it, and the area of positive psychology. These three are a set of related areas of now educational innovation that she is studying as a researcher. Here's a little example. How is it you introduce attention training to a really small children? At least in the West, especially in a secular setting, a public school setting, it has to be done in a careful way. Here the children are outside. They're listening to the sound of insects and the sound of birds, distant noise of traffic, and they realize they must become quiet, very quiet inside, in order to hear on the outside. So it's almost a natural exercise. It's not so much a constructed adult exercise, but something which the child will naturally be able to do. There are several such exercises which are modifications of mindfulness practices or other attention practices, well-wishing practices that allow the child in a suitable way to undertake some kind of contemplative training. What do the children say? Rather than quote lots of bar graphs and charts, I think I'll just read a couple of these statements by 10 or 11-year-olds. When you take deep breaths, you can calm yourself and it helps to clear your mind, says one 11-year-old. Another 10-year-old, Charlie, says, when I am angry, I just use what I learned so I can calm down. When asked whether they would recommend this program to a friend, they said, I want everyone to be kind and so not to be nervous and no stress, said David. So he would recommend. So the children themselves found benefit in this way of meditating gently. There's also a U.S. congressman, this is our government, Tim Ryan, has written a book called A Mindful Nation, where he speaks about, in his view, the power and importance of contemplative practices for the whole public setting. And finally, I'd like to also just mention a book that I wrote with Parker Palmer, which speaks to this question of integrated higher education. Now, Your Holiness, in New York, when you visited us last in the fall, you, as Diana Chapman Walsh mentioned, made a strong plea for secular ethics. And this has become now for us at the Minded Life Institute a real source and focus. We've raised considerable funding for the first year of work. Some of your friends, I won't mention them, but have given generously in support of this. And so when we come back in February, after leaving here, we'll be going back, Richie Davidson, I, Tunchin Jimpa, and about 25 others will come together as research scientists, master educators. We will come together to look exactly at this question of secular education and the introduction of ethics of compassion and kindness, generosity, and these sorts of virtues. We're going to be doing this, we hope, over the next several years. This year is basically a planning year to develop a full program. So in addition, I would say to the three areas that were part of Kimberly's area of mindfulness education program, I really feel there needs to be a strong component, a strong representation by secular ethics. I want to present a quotation about this that from Your Holiness, seeking a secular ethics. What we need today is an approach to ethics which makes no recourse to religion and can be equally acceptable to those with faith and without faith, a secular ethics. How is it we develop the innate qualities of generosity and compassion, altruism, throughout life? Here I show a picture of Socrates, one of the great exemplars in the West of a man who lived relentlessly an ethical life and sought to teach his students to do likewise. You should know, of course, that Socrates was condemned to death for teaching this. It was considered to be a corruption of the youth of Athens to have them ask questions, to have them really inquire deeply and to challenge their tradition.
Socrates.
Yeah. Seems like I keep bringing these sad stories, you know, Galileo on trial, Socrates on trial. But it's when one takes these questions up, they don't always immediately find a warm response because one is taking up important but difficult and challenging themes. So one has to have courage. Mother Teresa is an example of the kind of compassion and altruism we seek to cultivate in our students. We need to not only speak about it, but to cultivate, to inform, and develop our character so that we embody in ourselves that which we wish to see in the world. I think of Mahatma Gandhi's phrase, to be the change you want and see in the world. But how is it that we can see and become that change we want to see in the world? Is there a curriculum and pedagogy for secular ethics? And can that curriculum and pedagogy be grounded, well grounded, so that early childhood and social perceptions, which we can now study in the laboratory, in the infant cognition laboratories, show what we all feel must be the case, that the human being is at root good, is at root, has these capacities for altruism and compassion? How do we cultivate what is given, receive them, train them, and so forth? You know, we now have studies which show that children prefer to give than to receive. There's evidence for the innate generosity and compassion. So what's called for today is really a curriculum and pedagogy that will build on what it is that's innate in human beings. And so I'd like to conclude by saying we stand before, I think, a great opportunity, an opportunity to develop what are age-appropriate practices, that we do not treat the small child like an older adult, but that we find ways at each stage of the human being's life to cultivate and support their development, especially the development of those virtues which we hold to be the highest. Also, I wanted to emphasize this adult contemplative practice is for me a way of knowing. A way of knowing that is not only traditional, abstract, scientific in its character, but a way of knowing which is transformative of who we actually are, so that our view and the way we see the world is compassionate. It's not only a concept or a precept that we must obey, but we've changed ourselves thoroughly so that as we know the world, we know it also in ways that lead to compassion and love. Then I feel that these two great streams of wisdom and love can, or compassion can come together. We will not have forgotten our purpose. We will, in fact, have found our purpose for Western education as well as for the monastic educations and universities. So in this way, I celebrate this meeting and hope that the applications of which we've been talking find their way fully into education as well as the clinical settings. Thank you, Your Holiness.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Arthur. Well, we will move, unless, would you like to ask questions or you're fine if we move on, Your Holiness?
Okay, we do.
Fine to move on. Good. All right, then next we hear from Geshe Samten, someone you know very well, who will take up, in some ways, the same topic of higher education and education from and ethics, from a Buddhist perspective, the question of how we can provide an education that will transform students, their values, their ethics. A term we use in the West is character, and this is something Geshe La has thought about a great deal. As you know, he's vice chancellor of the Central University of Tibetan Studies in Saranath, Varanasi, and he has put aside his own scholarship, which he deeply loves, I know, because he and I have had some time together, to do this administrative work. And we've talked about both the sacrifices and the rewards, putting aside one's personal scholarly work in order to lead an institution. And he has clearly done it with great distinction. So we salute you, Geshe La. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Shasta. How do you mean?
It's you need to do the ratio. Can you do the ratio? The ratio is wrong. The projector is not centered. Projector.
Yes.
Projector.
Okay.
No. Is it good? Okay.
Your Holiness, Shajan Chujan Nambangi, the abbots and ex-abbots, the reincarnated, reincarnated lamas, the members of the Sangha, Professor Diana and the distinguished scientists and scholars and friends. It is always most challenging to speak in front of His Holiness. And I always feel myself taking a test when I speak, make presentation in front
and
of
all, His Holiness. All those, the Tibetan side speaker, including me too, they always say in front of me, you see, they find some difficulties. So that indicates I'm something dictator. Actually not. I think you should observe.
secular ethics and understanding of reality. The education of secular ethics. The meaning of education, as we have in modern world, is confined to dissemination of information, and specializations in certain external fields. Whereas in Indian system and in Tibetan system, the education means shiksha, and in Tibetan laba, which means it has a content of, a connotation of transformation, transformative measures. But unfortunately, in modern India, even though they retain the term shiksha, the content is very much lost, as it used to have in the past. So it is more or less similar, equivalent to education in the modern world. So people realize that the modern education system has failed to educate people in a holistic way by providing both intellectual and moral trainings. It is strongly felt that there is an urgent requirement of education to develop good heart. The secular ethics proposed by His Holiness the Dalai Lama is certainly a great idea to solve the global crisis of morality, given the fact that the modern society is multi-religious, a big portion of society is non-believers, there is a sizable portion of society which, although subscribes to a religion, is not happy with the belief systems of the ethics provided in there. Because when we meet many people, they say that, although I belong to this particular religious system, I'm not satisfied, and it is not convincing that, you know, the ethical advices and the systems it has is not that much convincing and, you know, promising. So, since such an education is secular in nature and is not based on any religious belief systems, it should be presented objectively in a scientific way. And mind is the forerunner of all the actions of speech and body. Negativity and positivity of actions depend on mind. It is extremely important to know the mind and how it influences action and behaviors. Hence, an account of mental system, a map of mind, should be demonstrated, showing the characteristics of mind, the constructive and destructive mental factors, their functions and impacts on the one hand, and how the destructive ones can be regulated, reduced with the application of antidotal factors, and how the constructive ones can be enhanced on the other hand. Many are not aware of this fact, and many have misconceptions about them, because we can see that in our common world, many people are not even aware of these different mental factors and how mind functions. For example, anger, for example, many people think that anger is a kind of inherently, you know, intrinsic nature of our personality, and there cannot be brought any kind of change with respect to the anger, presence of anger in their life. And sometimes even there are people who say that, you know, anger is a protective measure for our life, therefore we must have anger. So these kind of misconceptions are there in people, and let alone among the common people, but with many of the great philosophers there are, you know, such misconceptions. Like, for example, Aristotle, the great philosopher of Greece, has said that a certain degree of anger is permissible under certain circumstance, and with the appropriate attitude. And also the Stoics have said that let alone the negative emotions, but every kind of emotion is to be abandoned, is to be should be eliminated. So there are certain, the Stoics believe that even the positive emotions cause suffering, therefore every kind of emotion should be eliminated. So therefore there are lots of misconceptions and misunderstandings about emotion and our mental system. So therefore this kind of a map of mind should be demonstrated, so that they can understand how mind functions, how the positive mind functions, what are the natures of the positive mind and what are the natures of negative mind, how they can be reduced, and is there any kind of way, you know, way of developing antidotal factors with the help of which the negative mental factors and negative mental forces can be reduced and finally be eliminated. The scientific findings through the neurological researches about the indications of constructive and destructive mental factors on the brain and their implications on behavior would certainly be convincing to demonstrate the fact that the emotions can be regulated. So we have heard about this for the last three days. We have been hearing about the physics and then neuroscience, and yesterday we heard about the consciousness. And today with Professor Arthur and Professor Sona, they have presented about the science of clinical application of contemplative practice and the contemplative pedagogy as the heart of the heart of education. So I think it is unimaginable in the past, maybe we can say that about two decades from now, the scientists doing researches on these kind of things, and the leading brain scientists doing research on the mind and mental episodes or the mental factors and how they can be manipulated or how they can be reduced, the negative mental factors can be reduced, and what are the negative impacts of these negative forces in our life and in our body and health, and how this the positive can be promoted and can be cultivated further, which has positive implications on our health and life. So these are not imaginable quite some time back, but this is wonderful to see that now the scientists, some of the leading scientists, and in many of the fields of the science, these kind of researches are being undertaken. So similarly, the findings of clinical researches such as on mindfulness and compassion and their effects on the problems like attention deficiency would be useful to demonstrate that the mental problems can be solved with the training of mind. The secular ethics should be introduced through a secular and universal language. It should be taught not like a regular course, but with intensive interaction with the teachers, so that the transformative measures could be properly communicated and the value could be inculcated. And as we have seen with the Arthur's presentation, that he teaching students, young students, and even the adult students how to do meditation, and through that kind of procedures, attaining some kind of some kind of results in their life. As a result of the course, students should learn a regulation of emotions at least to some extent in the beginning, and gradually bring some transformation in their mental state, which will certainly bring changes in their social behavior and eventually become a better person. His Holiness's books on secular ethics are widely read across the world. Once the education of secular ethics is incorporated into the curriculum of schools, colleges, and universities, with the properly designed syllabus and good teachers, we will get to see the results. And I think this is one of the visions of His Holiness. The Delhi University, which is one of the leading universities in the capital of India, is going to start a course on secular ethics under the guidance of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. His Holiness is a visiting professor of Delhi University and has been giving lectures in that university for the last more than a couple of years. And with the influence of His Holiness's idea, the Delhi University has come up with this project of introducing secular ethics in their curriculum. And for the last 2 years, we have been working because Delhi University is very sensitive in terms of not bringing any kind of religious element into that, although they want very much to have the to incorporate the ideas of His Holiness into this. So we have been trying to design a course which could be acceptable to all the students and scholars from all, even the non-religious and non-believers of the religious. Recently, His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the author and Tania Singer and Richard Davidson were also there in making some presentations on these subjects, and Delhi University, the officials, the leaders, including the Vice Chancellor, were very much devoted to introduce this course in Delhi University. And once this course is launched, it will benefit 6,000 students every year, and this is a large scale. And also, being one of the primary and leading university in the world, this will have a lot of implication to the rest of the universities and educational institutions in India. So after this, I would like to present you the Buddhist approach to ethics, so that Buddhism and Buddhist concept of concept and philosophy and practice of practice has lots of things to offer to the education of secular ethics. So I wanted to share with you the Buddhist approach to ethics. The concept of ethics in the West is primarily related to behavior. According to Buddhism, ethics, the Shila in Sanskrit and Sultam in Tibetan, covers a wide area: the ethics of mind, ethics of speech, and ethics of body. And in terms of the wide range, you know, spectrum of the ethics, and also in terms of the subtleties, in Buddhism, it has a much more and deeper connotation and deeper meaning, deeper content. In Buddhism, the perfection of moral, with this you can see how the deep and high level of...
I want to add one thing. Sujim sa, sudhani songa ji, shenyu shidha jeba de dogwa, kata shenyu gangta yungto.
So in fact, at its core, at the most fundamental level, ethics in Buddhism or morality in Buddhism is defined in terms of restraining from any direct or indirect causes of harming others. So right from the beginning, at the very core of the understanding of ethics, you know, a concern for others' suffering is there, built into this.
And in Buddhism, the perfection of moral ethics is attained at a very high level of spiritual path. That is, only after having the direct perception of ultimate reality. In the subsequent process of gradual paths, the remaining afflictive mental elements are eliminated, and thereafter the subtlest obscurations as well are eliminated, after which the complete enlightenment, the Buddhahood, is attained. So from here you can understand that the level of ethics in Buddhism. The Buddhist approach to the modes modes of encountering the afflictive emotions. There are levels of different levels, and at which you can encounter the afflictive emotions. Avoiding object is regarded to be the first and the easiest way to encounter afflictive emotions. Because many of the masters have said that for beginners and for common people, and particularly to the beginners, it is much easier to avoid the object rather than developing antidotal factors. And in the second level, the application...
I must say, this is the initial stage.
It's important to emphasize that the first approach is really at the initial stage, because otherwise it would give the suggestion that all the Buddhist people who are concerned in development of ethics are avoiding everything.
oh, oh. I think the very sort of the kaso the essence of the kaso moral
practice.
Ethics. If you can serve, help other, you should do that. If you cannot, at least restrain harming. So if you completely avoid, then no possibility to serve.
Serve others.
Get it, I just get
there.
The second level, then application of regulation of emotions through training and practice. So there are a number of, you know, ways how to regulate your emotions and through the training of practices. So for example, when, you know, anger, somebody triggers anger, then there are certain ways of to think and to, you know, number of reasonings that how I should not, you know, have anger at such a given situation and things like that, so that we can, you know, avoid triggering anger. So there are a number of ways for this kind of application of, you know, the methods. And then after that, the third level is subjugation through non-transcendental paths. That is, so with the training in mindfulness and single point of concentration, and in with the subsequent paths, the practice of paths, that one reaches to a level when there is no kind of, you know, one would feel that there is no more afflictive emotions in oneself, but it is not eliminated. Still, there are they are subsided, but they do exist and they are not eliminated. But with the help of the non-transcendental path, they are subdued to a great extent. And the last stage is the elimination of the negative emotions and negative mental factors with the transcendental path. So once one has had a direct perception of the ultimate reality, thereafter these afflictive mental forces start getting eliminated with the gradual processes of a path.
So the secular ethics
So in the context of secular ethics, just to correlate, His Holiness would say it is at up to the second level of those different.
Could use the training word the in a summary nane, koda kanda tribu kejun kejun shibetane laling at.
So because although you are not avoiding the conditions that would give rise to afflictions,
go back to
in fact you are encountering the conditions, but you deal with them by readjusting your attitudes, bringing in understanding to bear on your relationship.
Okay. No. Yes.
Transformative stages of reduction, of elimination, of reduction and elimination of destructive mental forces, cultivation of constructive mental forces, and cultivation of understanding of reality. So there are three stages in our training at understanding derived from hearing. For example, in case of the cultivation of compassion, and first of all, understanding should be derived from hearing, from study, and a thorough study of compassion. And after that, the reflection or contemplation, one should reflect on the results, on the causes and conditions and the nature of compassion, and under which circumstance compassion can be cultivated. Taking into account with all these things, through contemplation, when one reaches to a conviction and develops a conviction that one, the cultivation of compassion, and the compassion is certainly very beneficial, then one turns into the third stage of meditative practice, that at which stage that person meditates, and then with the familiarity with the developing familiarity with the compassion, then within the course of time, then he develops a compassion, and that kind of compassion, which is made with effort, and again with the further effort, then at at a level of time, then he reaches to a stage where the compassion becomes a spontaneous and effortless kind of thing. When any circumstance arises, then he has a spontaneous reaction or spontaneous compassion towards that object. In the similar manner, the cultivation of understanding of reality, again, there are three stages that one first studies the whole, the thorough study of the reality, and then after that, he reflects or contemplates on the nature of reality with this, you know, scores of reasonings and things like that. And after reaching to conviction, then he enters into the meditative practice. And when one enters into the meditative practice after a long time, then attains the, you know, the and realizes or has develops a proper and perfect understanding of the reality. So these are the
stages. 무슨 말이 들으실 수 있죠? 메디테이션을 꾸준히 들으실 수 있죠? 다 투중체 and 전달의 양야 삼단이 이지대, 봐. And 쉬고 뒤도 더더 고민되잖아요. And 쉬고 바로 your life. 들으신 듯이 하죠.
So one thing that could help understand the process here is the initially you hear about it, you learn about it. And then as a result of, you know, thinking about, reflecting upon it, and then processing it, then you, at one point, it can become part of you, part of your nature. So that's when you have arrived
part of your life.
Part of your life. Uh-huh. And so that's when you have arrived at this third stage.
That I think we can say, the third level. Yeah. Then no need effort, or that moment, some awareness, no. But automatically, some sort of occasion comes. And because you see, you get used through training, familiarize, so then automatically come.
So, in the case of in the view of interdependence or dependent arising or view of emptiness, at this stage, at the final stage, then the view of interdependence or view of emptiness becomes your own personal view rather than becoming that as a kind of, you know, external reality. It becomes your personal view. Buddhist masters have developed extensive methods of training the mind, providing detailed account of a variety of procedures to deal with the diverse mental states, and thus leading it gradually to advanced cognitive stages, culminating perfected awareness or the Buddhahood. Importance of understanding reality. Although there are measures by means of which one can reduce the negative mental elements and subdue them, the realization of reality is mandatory for their elimination. For these reasons, the Buddha and the subsequent Buddhist masters have given extensive philosophical teachings concerning the reality of phenomena, the core of all the Buddhist views about the nature of reality. Despite their variety, is the principle of dependent origination. Due to these reasons, in Buddhism, philosophy is not simply for the sake of knowledge, but is practically related to the elimination of suffering. Many masters have emphatically stated that if the study of reality is confined to mere knowledge, the very purpose of the philosophy is undermined. Therefore, in Buddhism, philosophy and spirituality are inextricably intertwined. So, importance of teachings on impermanence as a reality. Although impermanence is not the ultimate reality of an ultimate reality, it is an extremely important reality. This is one of the four seals of Buddhist philosophy. And the Buddha gave a lot of, you know, importance on the teachings of the. Lots of importance on the nature of the impermanence of the composite phenomena. And when Buddha gave the teachings on impermanence, all of the non-Buddhist Indian philosophical schools had a very serious reactions against this view, saying that this totally contradicts with the nature, because when we see the mountains and houses and cups and everything, then we see them. Yesterday we have seen them, and today we are seeing them. So how can these be a momentary and flux? So it contradicts our experience, and therefore the Buddhists were charged of being contradictory to the real experience, mm-hmm. and contradictory, and it is said in Sanskrit, the khyana bhanguruvada, the proponents of momentariness, which is, you know, totally contradicting the reality. So, but now I think that there is no such a kind of criticisms, because it is already very well proven by the scientists that even a second can be divided into millions of fractions. So I think it is very much corroborated by the scientists' findings. And this is an intellectual understanding of impermanence is not sufficient, but it has to be internalized. The understanding, even though we understand through machines and through intellectual study, understand the impermanence and the flux of the composite phenomena, but if we don't internalize it, or if the view of impermanence doesn't become our own personal view, then there is no benefit of this, the understanding of impermanence. Our view of seeing the composite things as permanent needs to be replaced by the view of impermanence. The cultivation of view of impermanence has immense impact on our life, because the person, even in Buddhism, even they technically do not understand the million fractions of as part of a second, but when they understand that every composite phenomena is a flux and changes every moment, and there is no such a fraction of time during which anything stands still, so with that kind of cultivation of the notion of impermanence, the person has develops a certain deep kind of, you know, it has a deep impact on their life in terms of what, you know, looking on the objects, and in terms of when they lose some of their near and dear beings, and when they lose some of their properties or belongings or something like that, so it doesn't have that kind of a negative impact on their life. So there are so many different kinds of impact on their life due to the understanding of impermanence. In the similar manner, the view of interdependent dependence and emptiness is extremely important, as it destroys our view of seeing internal and external phenomena as inherently existent, on the ground of which all the afflictive mental forces arise. Without the cultivation of a view of emptiness, the negative mental elements can only be subdued but can never be eliminated or eradicated, as their foundation remains intact. According to Buddhism, every afflictive mental element arises from an inappropriate attitude towards subjects, towards objects. The inappropriate attitude in turn arises from a distorted view of the reality of the object, which is a fundamental ignorance about the nature of reality per se. That ignorance consists in viewing objects as substantially or inherently existent, that is, as existing independent of other phenomena. With the inappropriate attitude, the object appears to be either attractive or repulsive, which leads to the development of attachment and aversion. Buddhism suggests the possibility of high level of moral development through transformative measures, which is grounded on the perception of reality. Therefore, Buddhism can make a substantial contribution to the development of secular ethics and secular education. Scientific researches on the positive and negative emotions and on the transformative trainings would certainly be beneficial to the education of secular ethics. Thus, I'm optimistic that the interaction between science and Buddhist tradition would play a significant role in the development of secular ethics, besides its wider role in raising the horizon of knowledge and thereby benefiting the people of the world through bringing peace in their mind and life. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Very good, very good, very good. Very good.
We have a little time before we break. So first, as always, I would invite Your Holiness, if you have questions, questions you would like to raise with anyone who has spoken. We have about 15 minutes, or we can go to lunch if you prefer.
다산이 want to to share is my concern about secular ethics. Now we are here, except heat, otherwise comfortable, our stomach full, and quite comfortably sort of sleep. But same time, same moment, same planet, same human being, some starvation, some killing. Some, I think, 24 hours remain hopelessly. Now we are social animals. If the world remains like this, I think ultimately we also will be facing some problems. So each individual out of 7 billion human beings, from their own sort of, because of the selfish viewpoint, you cannot ignore, isn't that fact? You have to think seriously. And particularly we Buddhist, the Delhi I mentioned also, you see, we always pray, all mother-centered being. It seems, you see, the mother-centered being which we really take seriously is not on this planet, but some other planet. If we really, sincerely praying for well-being of mother-centered being, firstly, mother-centered being on this planet, firstly, human being, then other animals. We cannot sort of educate other animals, but a lot of suffering due to human behavior, human greed. No consider they have experience of pain and pleasure. So I think extreme way of exploitation, isn't it? So if we human beings, 7 billion human beings, becoming more compassionate, more sensible, I think billions, billions of trillions of other sentient beings, I think, comparatively, I think less disturbances. So now, you have to think, you see, that sort of serious sort of matter. That also, I think, another factor, human population increasing. Climate, global warming also now coming. So perhaps, I think a problem will increase. So this also is becoming source of conflict, killing, fighting. And then now, try to source of sort of hope.
Solution.
Religion as the at the beginning I mentioned, I think a few thousand years people totally sort of put our hope on faith. Even I think in the 20th century, during those war time, I think each side pray. So sometimes I jokingly tell people, I think God also will make confuse where his sort of blessing should go, this side or that side. It's both sides killing each other, meantime pray to God. Isn't it difficult? So then the worst thing, religion itself causing some problems. Firstly, dividing human beings. If we take religion seriously, sincerely, then all major religious tradition, you see, talks love, compassion, forgiveness, tolerance, self-discipline, these things. But a major portion of religious believers don't care. You see, these real is sort of message of religions. So religion corrupted. And as a matter of fact, I think as in his presentation you mentioned, is a large portion of humanity essentially non-believer. And even those people who say believer, who say Christian, who say Buddhist, who say Hindu, real life don't care about religious practice, religious message. Then education. Comparatively, I think generally speaking, I think during the 20th century, I think the education highly sort of kasoda,
advanced.
Everywhere. Now, I think the recognition, awareness, importance of education is now universal, everywhere. Whether they can make effort or not, but people everywhere realize education, importance of education. But education really brought some good thing, including scientific knowledge. I think doubt. The 20th century, some historian say around 200 millions of people killed during the 20th century through violence, through war. So their education, I think helping such sort of tremendous sort of destructive, power of destructive, and scientists also, I think helped, not intentionally, but user of the knowledge of through scientific research, you see, utilized by wrong way. So the science also make tremendous contribution for human suffering. So mere education, I think those like September 11 sort of event, people who plan these things, I think very, very smart, I think people.
Right.
No. The dull people, uneducated people, you see, cannot make that kind of plan, that kind of sort of destructive work carry. Isn't it? So therefore, only hope is proper education. Education, religion, no matter how wonderful one religious tradition, like Buddhism. I think maybe I'm Buddhist, so maybe a little prejudiced, right?
Biased,
Biased. Yes, I feel this Buddhist approach is quite sort of a realistic way of approach. But Buddhism will never be universal religion. Clear. So now only thing is, only sort of the hope, education. Now in education, I'm extremely happy. You see, the Kazanai, Kazoda, Chiksananda.
Colleague. Friend.
Really, you see, caring, you see, the work, educate people about sort of warm-heartedness and meditation or mindfulness, these things. I very much appreciate, and some other, the scientists also now making clear the warm-heartedness is something very, very important. So in any way, so therefore, in education field, if you put some kasoda moral ethics, as you mentioned, from kindergarten up to university level, bol marbetegi, right? Eventually, you see, that way, I think can change human thinking. Through that way, human behavior then becoming much more positive. So, now in the education field, the moral ethics, if we is related with religious faith, then complications, a lot of complicated there. So there's no other choice except secular ethics. Not talking about next life, not talking about God, not talking about heaven or Buddha, like that. Simply, you see, try to educate people. I think every people, I think, knows if you see some more holistic view, that our world, not happy world, a lot of problem. If present sort of situation, present way of thinking, way of life continues, I think within this century, I think more problems will come. Although I have not much worry. Now 70, over 77, now 78, perhaps I think next one decade means 87, 88. Two decades, 98. Then I may go. So all problems remain at those younger people's hand or their shoulder. But as a human being, we have to think about coming generations. They also see human being. They also have exactly same sort of desire, same sort of feeling, right? Want happy life, do not want suffering, as we do. Perhaps we have used some experiences. So the elder generation, it is our responsibility, through our own experience, now show some sort of the more holistic way of coming generation. Now here, I think like me, religious people, we can cooperate or support. But main thing, I feel, scientist. Your knowledge not based on faith, but through actual sort of experiment, investigation. That means, you see, some of your knowledge, you see, come from reality. So your explanation, I think, easier to accept people, particularly non-believers. So therefore, in order to develop effective secular ethics, I think the scientific findings, scientist cooperation is very, very essential. I think at the beginning, I mentioned such meetings, two purposes. One, extend our knowledge. That's one purpose. One purpose is through
collaboration.
Through our knowledge, you see, how to make contribution. For better world, better human being. So now this is the second one.
Second goal.
Oh. So therefore, now you clearly sort of make a presentation about the secular ethics, these things. So as he mentioned, this month in Delhi, as a result of a few years our sort of discussion. Now, Delhi University, under the leadership of this chancellor, vice chancellor, actually is materialized. Now, secular ethics should be sort of included
into
them.
Islam, incorporated into the training.
So now there, I mentioned, I think you also noticed, you see, now we should sort of set up small sort of committee or small group of people who now actually start, who should start the curriculum entirely based on secular secular
approach,
and can be curriculum in the secular education field. As you notice there, you witness there. So now, so for material there, I think from kindergarten up to university level. So when we talk about just this morning, you see, I discussed with some of them, to some of them, with some of them. That sort of the curriculum, that subject, I think basically any moral ethics must, now secular basis, any moral ethics must come from intelligence, knowledge, not faith. So therefore, in the curriculum, first explain as an academic subject about the usually I call map of mind or emotion. No concept of right or wrong. Simply mention, make clear map of the emotion. Then such emotions are very bad for our peace of mind, through that way, very bad for our health, and very bad the happy family, happy community. Make clear that. Then, now how to deal these things? Then moral ethics come. So first, as basis, just academic subject. Then through that way, some kind of conclusion. You see, some of these sort of emotions are very harmful, some of the emotions are very helpful. So now how to deal? So sometimes I describe hygiene of emotion. Right. Hygiene of physical, hygiene of emotion. So from kindergarten, some kind of that, quite simple. Right?
In simple forms.
So you have the picture, you just book those things.
So I was very impressed by that beautiful shot of children meditating.
Oh, wasn't that wonderful?
Oh.
Yes.
Very nice.
Yes.
So in any way, from low-level education, yeah. Right? Yeah. Then up to university, see that I think that's what
the subject.
That's
course. The map of mind.
Oh, the Marmumari. No. The Kasala. Lobsen. That's syllabus. You can extend, right?
Expand.
At the university level, we can mention the other day you see the Kasa the presentation, you see.
He gave a list of all the mental factors and how dynamic they were.
So then, see, I think worthwhile university level subject of academic, right? A lot of vipassana. He mentioned this vipassana, insight or single-pointed mind. All these you can then elaborate. So we already started. I have a little jealousy. You already sort of implement these things. We here not yet implement, including Tibetan schools not yet implemented. So wonderful. Charanda pilot chatter.
So in a sense, you have become the pilot.
Oh, so wonderful, wonderful. So that's, you see, because of that, my views, our view. This is not sort of out of sort of some kind of happy sort of the happy mood. No. Then is it find some new things? No. We are facing desperate situation. There's no other choice. Making more money can solve this? No. More scientific technology can solve this to some extent, but not complete. Ultimately, problems start from here. Negative emotion, with the help of intelligence, the immense destructions, immense suffering, they happen. So here, we already education dealing with this. Now here, religion, difficult. Some extent, or even religion, once we develop education, through education, awareness, these secular ethics, then religion become kasoda.
More grounded.
Oh, then people, some people, you see this, once you see sort of tremendous, sort of real enthusiasm or realization about the importance of these moral ethics, then religions, all major religions, you see, talking that, use different philosophical views. So then different religious tradition also becoming more stronger. This is my feeling. So therefore, my book, The Ethics Beyond Religion, a few occasions I mentioned, this is not my kaza.
Choice. The title was not by his holiness.
I think some extent, I didn't have the responsibility, I think. So I, when I first saw that, I felt, you see, some people might get the sort of impression the subject which I mentioned is something more sacred than religion. No. Actually, you see, the subject which I'm presenting is the basis of all major religious traditions. But itself, not based on religion. So, beyond. Religion sometimes, you see, makes some
kind of
boundary. Now, this is something universal. So, from that sense, beyond. Clear. So like that. So our monks here also, and also students, we are part of 7 billion human beings. And if not 24 hours, but at least, you see, in daily, think these things. I almost listen BBC every time. Some kind of sad news always happen. If we accept this now nature, then we are not a human being. Investigate what's the causes and what's the remedy. That's the human beings sort of because of the responsibility. Right. Animal, some. Whether becomes something like threat their life. They simply accept that. We human beings try to investigate, can avoid or not. Isn't it? Like that. So, that's all. Thank you.
Your Holiness, thank you. Thank you.
Now, another sort of say, human right is lunch for fulfill our empty stomach. And especially like this, need more fuel.
Human right is lunch.